Good evening. My name is Meg Stemmler, and I produce programs for Live from the NYPL. Please welcome Paul Holdengraber and George Prochnik.
I'm sorry that I have to break the silence, but I have to ask you what we just heard. I'm not quite sure.
That was a BBC recording of the 2 minutes of silence commemorating Armistice Day in 1938. England was really the first country that had a widely observed national moment of silence, and it was for Armistice Day, and it began in 1919. 10 years later, the BBC actually began broadcasting this live from the Cenotaph in the middle of London. And it proved enormously popular, so much so that it was continued for decades thereafter. And sometime in the 30s, a representative of the station spoke about what he thought was happening and why it was such an enormously popular event. And he said that its impressiveness was intensified by the fact that, of course, it's not dead silence. We hear Big Ben strike the hour, we listen to the bickering of sparrows, we hear the creasing of pigeon wings, he said. We hear all sorts of things in contrast to the din of traffic in London a moment before. And what he said the BBC's role was to allow people to recognize silence as a solvent which destroys personality and gives us leave to be great and universal.
It's quite a comment. Have they continued doing this?
They are not, to the best of my knowledge, broadcasting now. It stopped, and I think there may have been a brief assumption. It stopped, I want to say, about 20 years ago. And we might also note that recently, there was a whole scandal about moments of silence observed in stadiums, which had been 2 minutes, and which diminished to 1 minute. And the 2 minutes of silence, the real ancestor of that, was 3 minutes of silence that was sparsely observed in South Africa. So we see these minutes of silence getting shorter and shorter over time.
So we have 30 seconds of silence to look forward to.
If we're lucky.
You, towards the end of your book, In Pursuit of Silence, you write about a coalition of philanthropists who have purchased empty lots, and you encourage people to start hosting moments of silence. You say, let's hold a moment of silence in memory of silence. We have to find some means of giving more young people the opportunity of experientially learning why quiet is distinguished, or there will be no distinction between noise and signal left. What did you mean?
Well, I mean, certainly one of the most profound discoveries for me in the course of this pursuit was of how many people there are in the world today for whom there simply is literally no moment of silence in their lives. Particularly this is true in disadvantaged communities that I visited, where in the homes there will often be a television on, someone speaking in a radio, there'll be lots of people living there. The streets are blasting with traffic. And for young people to have any reason to aspire to a quieter world, I think we have a responsibility as a larger society to provide them with context and physical spaces in which that silence can be discovered. Silence doesn't just happen magically. It needs a space. And
it needs certain conditions.
It needs conditions, real world conditions. We might all have our own moments of silence, I mean, that are mystical or what have you, but silence very much needs a place in the here and now.
After hearing those 2 minutes of silence, I started by saying that I had to break that silence. And you write about this breaking of silence as it is perceived by some philosophers. For instance, you quote Wittgenstein's the end of the first book of philosophy with a proposition, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. And then you quote Heidegger, who once said, who declared, above all, silence about silence.
Words that haunted me throughout the writing of this book, particularly because this was part of a dialogue he carried on with a Japanese scholar, and the rejoinder of the scholar to this was, yes, because those who speak about silence produce the most obnoxious chatter. And I thought also that we'd gotten trapped in our ways of pitting noise lovers, or people at least who are loud, against noise haters, and we hadn't thought of any ways of speaking about silence that of a more sociable form of silence. We were positioning it all in terms of an inward journey. But I saw our social landscape as having this deficit which infects our politics profoundly. And one quote that really stuck with me from Supreme Court Justice Frankfurter, he spoke of how when the Constitution was being written, the men, the framers of the Constitution, had the road in front of Independence Hall covered with earth so that their deliberations would not be disturbed by passing traffic, because they felt our democracy presupposed the deliberative process as a condition of thought and responsible choice by the electorate. And at this moment in our discourse, I think the noise level and the efforts to dominate dialogue simply by volume of rhetoric have really given us a deficit of listening.
What do you think the etymology of both the words silence and noise tells us?
Well, if we start with noise, the etymology goes...
It's the right direction in which to go, from noise to silence.
I think... we go back to nausea, we go back to vertigo, seasickness. And many people have struggled with coming up with words with which to define noise. It's such a trap because it's so subjective, and people speak of unwanted sound, but so much of the noise is noise we desire. And people speak of unnecessary sound, but how do we begin to determine really what is necessary and not necessary in sound? And I came to think of noise as sound that, whether it was good or bad, gets inside our head and we can't get away from it. For the time that we're in a noise, it dominates our perception of the world. So we don't have room for other perceptions, even if it's something pleasurable. The idea of vertigo, I think, ties deeply into this, because we're swimming in a sound that has gone inside us and turned us into a little rocking boat.
So that noise, in some way, might we be correct in assuming that it robs us of our identity in some form or fashion?
It's a complex idea, but I think that actually that can be said. Let's circle back to that and say one thing about the etymology of silence, because I think it also speaks to that question. Two of the key antecedents for the word silence: one is a Gothic verb, anasalen, which means the wind dying down, and then the Latin desinere, meaning stop. So we have to think of silence as interrupted action, as the kind, it's a very particular kind of action. It's a kind of action where we hold back from action. And what does that entail? And what, on the flip side, is the form of action which happens in the space of noise, that pushes us out of reflection, out of processing our environment, into a reactive state? When I think about the idea of losing identity in noise, I think about having to become Teflon in some way to what's stimulating me, so that I don't have time to absorb it, to digest it, to let it become part of me.
When I read the etymology of noise in your book, which I didn't know, I was reminded of a poem by Baudelaire, Une Passante, the first line of which is in French, La rue assourdissante autour de moi hurlait, amid the deafening sound of the street screamed. The street in a sense is screaming. Is that what noise does? It just sort of robs us of our, it invades us so much that we can't function anymore.
I think invasion is a good word, and something that certainly many people that I spoke with over the course of my travels feel about this moment in our sonic world. They feel that they can't get away from the noise, that there's so many different sources coming at them that they no longer have what I think of as these pockets of silence which may have been present in the past. And this might be moving too far forward, but...
No, but pockets leads me to one of my favorite moments in your book. And in a way, I was reading that poem of Baudelaire in Benjamin's beautiful book on Baudelaire. Your book itself is very Benjaminian in nature for me. It's a flânerie across many continents, but in particular, I think a certain concentration not only on Brooklyn, but also on certain parts of New York. And one of the minor heroes of this book is someone we don't usually think of as a hero, which is Thomas Hoving, who we all know as the former director before Philip de Montebello of the Metropolitan Museum, where he created, as I recall, the notion of the blockbuster. I've always been in... Do you know where the etymology, where the origin of the word blockbuster?
I don't.
That's interesting.
Tell me.
I'll tell you. The origin of the word blockbuster comes from the First World War, where bombs were dropped and would bust a whole block. Interestingly enough, the contrary of a blockbuster now is we call something that bombs, right? Which is quite interesting. But
you know, that's actually right. This is very germane, because the origin of Hoving, what we're going to speak about, these very small parks that are called pocket parks that I came to feel were a real signal of hope in the midst of all the noise, was in fact bombed out lots in European cities that were, in certain instances, rather than rebuilding, these were turned into small parks. And gradually, I mean, there was an idea that went back to Jacob Riis, but the first actually created parks were these ones in Europe. And then in America, there were a couple of scattered experiments, but Thomas Hoving...
Tell the story of how he... Because he went from these pockets of silence that he found to creating something quite the contrary, those blockbusters where noise was prevalent. So I'm interested...
I don't know if I can trace the transition from one to the other,
but
I can
say... You don't have to, but talk about the pocket parks.
He was briefly, before becoming the director of the Metropolitan Museum, he was the New York City Park Commissioner. And with all the controversy that surrounded his tenure at the museum, as a park commissioner, he really got rave reviews from a remarkable cross-section of the city, politically, in terms of, in every sense. And one of the reasons that he got this strong sense of accolade was because people felt he was really making, for the first time, parks for the people. And one of the, for me, most meaningful legacies of what he did, because some of the happenings and things that he organized in the parks, they haven't left so much, I think, a mark on us today. I would have liked to have seen some of them, because some of them sounded very interesting, but we don't really have anything comparable now. But what he did do was he created the city's first pocket park, Paley's Park, which is in Midtown, and there's another beautiful one.
10 blocks from here.
Very close to here, very close to the Museum of Modern Art. And he got William Paley, the CBS director, to finance the building of a park that just would take over a slit, a little building lot, and he put in a water feature, and he planted it with types of foliage that were very effective at absorbing sound. I don't know at that point how consciously that was part of what he did, but it's the case. And you step into this park, and you feel an enormous sense of respite from the din of the city. It's small, but it does a lot of what even much bigger silences can accomplish. And since Paley's Park was created in the late 60s, Now we live in a time where, despite our sense of being so besieged, there is real hope, I think, in people who've built on this kind of work, learning much more about the ways that we perceive sound. And there are all sorts of fascinating studies that have been done looking at how the admixture of natural sound, even over a fairly heavily industrial trafficked area, can produce perceptions that are in the same family as silence. Even if, in a literal sense, say, water sounds, bird sounds, add another few decibels, people feel it to be quieter. And there are lots and lots of interesting, there's lots and lots of interesting work being done on these minutiae of what makes a difference. I mean, they found, for example, with water, you don't want water going over a metal grating, because this reminds people of drainage. But if you have it, the ideal setting seems to be over small, irregular boulders, that this produces particularly certain high-frequency sounds that are just pleasing and that give us a sense of peace. So we don't, you know, we're not going to be able to go back to some mythical moment. And this is something I know that you want to talk about. And
I'm interested in getting slowly to what I see a tendency in you of finding a prelapsarian self, a moment of silence that we, with some hope, might be able to get to, but which may never have actually existed.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think if we think about this moment in time, in terms of the pursuit of silence, it's a triply post-lapsarian moment. We're living after the third sonic fall. And I think this is the case because, first of all, as we all know, there is no absolute silence. There's nothing there. Absolute silence is the ending of all vibrations, is total death. Then we have the second layer of sound, which is infrastructure sound, the traffic noise from road and air and from manufacturing process that we've been living with for generations and that we've allowed to really dominate our what some people refer to as the soundscape, the acoustical landscape in which we live. And now, on top of that, I believe and argue, partly because of that second layer, that second sonic fall, we have the third layer where we, to soundproof ourselves, and in fact, to create a version of silence, which I can explain why I mean that, we plug in, we put on our earbuds, we put on our headphones, we put on our own sound devices as a way of both exerting control over the noise so that at least if we are going to be dominated by noise, it's noise we choose. And also because, frankly, we've turned so many of our public spaces into noise dumping grounds that what we can put through a direct sound feed into our ears is often more interesting. And I think it's important to say that there is a tendency among my generation to look at, you know, young people with ubiquitous use of iPods and et cetera, and sort of say, turn it off and get it down, and, you know, why are you doing that? It's so loud. But I really think the responsibility as to why that happened lies with us. So
we're complicitous in some way.
We're collaborators because we didn't, if we knew something about silence while there still was some, we didn't do a very good about sharing our knowledge of what benefits silence might bring. And we didn't go about certainly creating democratically accessible spaces where silence could take place.
Is there not something a little bit odd and maybe precious in the notion of fabricating silence?
I don't think this is about fabricating silence. I think it's about defabricating the noise. I mean, and this gets into some of the terminology that's directly used by some of the soundscapers and urban planners who I really like.
Say something about soundscaping.
Yeah, okay. Well, this is a term.
It's a
term that is bandied about very loosely, and it can mean pretty much, it seems at this point, what anyone wants it to mean. But in some way, I guess there's a beautiful, beautiful book by Murray Schafer called The Soundscape. That came out now, I guess, probably 30 years ago, that looks at a whole, he coined the phrase, really, and he looked at a whole number of aspects of what is the sonic world that we live in, and tried to analyze them and talk about
according
what
according to different cities, also?
Different cities and different places.
Different cities sound differently.
Different cities, well, this is a whole subject in itself. But I'm using it now in the sense of people who work to encourage, not to fabricate, but to encourage certain sounds and to maybe discourage certain others. And often it's a very, very low-tech enterprise. Well, let me jump into a specific example. In London, in Trafalgar Square, there was a man I spoke with who was an urban planner who was very conscious that the fountain in the center of the square could no longer be heard from anywhere. And he felt this was a real shame.
And a loss.
And a terrible loss. But he also found that simply by diverting traffic from one side of the square, that he freed up a channel for the sound to flow from the fountain and be bounced off the portico of the National Gallery right on top of where people were standing, which was exactly the point at which you would want to admire the sight and sound of the fountain together. Soundscapers like this speak of recovering iconic sounds of different environments. So what can you do if there was a church bell in a neighborhood, which was a beautiful thing, or there was a pocket of trees that actually was very conducive to biodiversity and created its own little bird chorusing? How can you recover that? How can you recover the sound of footsteps along a particular street? And the dark side of soundscaping is something else, which I think there's great dangers will become more and more part of our lives. There's a whole commercial side to it that's happening in cars and with products, and that's often about adding actually another layer of ostensibly pleasant electroacoustical sound. I visited, if I can just say one further thing, I visited a park in Sweden, in Malmo, which had an indentation. It was near all sorts of different activity, producing all sorts of different noise, from children, from people playing sports, not so far from a road, a very windy place. And they created a pocket of what could have been silence, which was a depression, just a very simple thing, a depression in the earth with rich plantings that walled off a lot of the sound. And then they stuck speakers all through the ground, and it was playing constantly music that they decided would help people's perception of silence. But, you know, maybe some people, and for a lot of people, it was just, I'm not in the mood for a kind of a hip muzak.
And you take us through, in your flânerie through various cities and through New York in particular, you take us to places where noise, as it were, is fabricated, whether it be in restaurants, whether it be in department stores, just an extraordinary level at which we are manipulated. Can you say a few words about that, but not too many, because I'd like to actually have us focus more on the oral truffles, which we'll get to in a minute.
Well, certainly in terms of restaurants. I spoke with many restaurateurs about why they're dining establishments were excruciatingly loud. And there really was a consensus.
And one can hear a laughter here because everybody in this room recognizes that. I mean, and there are no guidebooks that I know that have an entry quiet restaurants. And
there are, I mean, even in the New York Times reviews, they'll rate it. They will talk about tolerably loud, intolerably loud, and in San Francisco.
But I'd like a section. I'd like a section in the book.
I had a section. It didn't remain. There needed to be more silence in the book, so I didn't get to do it all. But you know, all of the restaurateurs spoke to me about a fear of seeming dead. They said, if we're not, you know, if a place is loud, and many of them said for them too, it was a counterintuitive discovery, that while they would have thought that noise at a certain level would have turned people off, they just found the louder it was, the more people sensed it was really happening. It had a literal buzz.
And by really happening, it also means people are drinking more.
Since you can't talk, you
open your mouth to drink. I mean, you do describe this
in the book. The most rigorous study that was done on this subject in France a couple of years ago found, while there's still uncertainties about what happens to our pace of eating, we definitely drink more when things are loud. And I would tie this in to the physical reality of sound as a stimulant. It's a particular kind of stimulant that makes us crave more stimulation. But we, you know, those of us who feel not so friendly towards noise a lot of the time have to understand that there's a real energy that you're given by it. And this form of stimulation, one study that I saw looking at the nature of this was actually looking at ecstasy with rats. And there were some Italian researchers who gave one group of rats ecstasy in a completely silent, kind of monastic rat environment. And another in the environment, which for those who've experienced this, this drug might be a little more typical for MDMA, of quite loud discotheque. And what they found was that the rats who were given ecstasy in relative silence, their brains cleared up overnight almost entirely. But the rats who were in the discotheque, the mini rat club, their brains were fried for a week. I mean, just the electrical cortical parameters were completely tangled and confused, and they were just a mess. Which reminds me of another rat experiment on the same subject. This one from 1930 in Tokyo, where there was a group of scientists who took two groups of rats, one of which they raised in the silence of the laboratory, and the other of which they raised beneath an elevated train with more than 1,200 passages back and forth every day. So they were convinced that what would happen to the rats underneath the train would be that they would just die from noise because it was so extreme. Their organs would collapse, they would be very unhappy, so on and so on. Well, in fact, the rats were very unhappy, and they were nervous wrecks, and they were aggressive, and they were less fertile, and they weren't as smart as the other rats. Less fertile. Their fertility. There have been studies looking at actually fertility rates close to airports that have found drops in human fertility as well. But the twist was that they found that the rats raised beneath the trains also lived 53 days longer than the rats raised in silence. So what this means, I haven't seen a follow-up that says 1930, the Tokyo Hygiene Laboratory, but it suggests to me that, and they repeated it afterwards, they had a group of rats raised in the main newsroom of a major daily in Tokyo, and then they had rats raised next to a very loud, constantly ringing bell. And in each instance, the results were the same. The rats raised in noise were horrible rats to be around and very unhappy rats, but they had longevity of a really impressive...
So they were horrible to be around for a long time. Yeah. I would like to, first of all, pause for a moment to recognize our signers and thank them so much for being here. This is the very first time, at least in the experience I've had with this program, that we have had signers. So thank you very much.
I'd like
everybody to
thank
them.
Yeah, I want to interrupt the applause because the correct way to applaud, if you're applauding within the deaf community, is actually not by making noise, but to raise your hands over your heads and kind of twist them. So let's have everyone give applause that will be recognized in this way. Thanks. Thank you very much.
You start out the book and finish the book, actually, being rather worried of your own kindness towards the world. And you say, I'll only read this one line on the very first page in the introduction, that you're scared of becoming a noise crank.
I mean, it's scary.
But yes, it is scary, but George, are you a noise crank?
Well, let me just say...
in my defense. No.
I have always had an affinity to silence. I don't know if that makes... That sounds a lot better. I don't know if that makes me automatically a noise crank. But I've had this affinity to silence, and it's bound up with my passion for reading, which I've had for as long as I've had an identity. And I think of a line by a writer that we both care for, Stefan Zweig, the turn-of-the-century Viennese writer, who once defined a book as a handful of silence that assuages torment and unrest. And I knew that I'd had this instinctual predilection all my life. As I grew older, I was aware that there seemed to be less and less of the silence that I was drawn to be had. And I really set out on this pursuit, trying to determine whether there was an objective change in the world of sound, or whether I was just becoming more crotchety with age.
And which I found, is a tendency
which
in
is
all
a
of
tendency,
us.
Which is a tendency. And I can say something, if you'd like, about where I ended up coming down in terms of the question of whether or not anything has changed.
Yes.
I think something has changed. But I think it's a mistake to...
Changed in...
In terms of what we hear in the world around us.
And the volume of what we hear.
Well, that's a trickier question. And let's Let's back into it. Okay. Certainly, if we were to go to a Victorian industrial city, if we were to be living in mid-19th century London, it would be very possible that where we were living was much, much louder than where most of us are living today, because you might be living next to a factory with very long hours, and the factory might be doing extremely heavy manufacturing of one sort or another. In fact, there are all sorts of issues that where I think progress has been made in terms of zoning noise. And there's a fascinating paper that I came across that speculated that the Greek city-state of Sybaris might have become as refined and sophisticated as it did entirely because they had early noise zoning. But it didn't exist for most cities for most of time. I think there were many, many objectively very loud noise sources. However, that said, if you were living in mid-19th century London, or at least in many, many other places, I think it was much easier to find the kinds of pockets of silence from which you could take some refuge, some peace, find some sense of sanctuary than many of us have today. I think that there was more of what some urbanists speak of as acoustical contrast than we readily have access to. So that part of why we feel so besieged, I believe, with sound, with types of sounds that sometimes are not objectively all that loud, has to do with the fact that it's an incessant barrage of these sounds.
And you, in your journey, actually went out to find the loudest among the communities who barrage themselves willfully with
sound. It's the loudest outside of military activity, and so in a way the loudest, yes, that's entirely willful, which was the world of extreme car audio competition.
And we had the idea at one moment, George and I, when we were putting this event together, to somehow feature some of it, and then we decided to go more towards silence and
well, we thought about trying to get some of the people I met, some of whom I felt very fondly towards, is the reality, try to come up with their cars. But their cars are to it's like moving a dinosaur to move them around. Most of them don't drive. They're stuffed with, you know, a dozen car batteries. They're not really made to drive.
What do they do?
All they do is play music. They're walled off.
And you went in one of those cars.
I went in one of those cars.
And describe the experience.
Well, what really stands out for me in the experience that I had, I thought it would be fun to drive around in one of these cars, like they do, like they like to drive around, and sort of feel what it was like. And I got in the car, and this was in Florida, and I haven't spent much time in Florida. It was a very ugly part of Florida, but an area with many, many big highways. And it was pretty fun driving down the highway, booming along, and we were playing the music, and I thought, oh, you know, I get this. I thought this was fine. And then suddenly there was a dashboard. The whole inside of the car, I should say, was covered with black. It was, all the windows were painted with metallic reflecting surfaces. You couldn't see anything, and there were coils, and you felt like you were inside Frankenstein's head, not exactly inside a car. And suddenly there was a lunar panel, I thought of as a lunar panel, on a science fiction vessel, lit up, and the finger of my companion started pushing buttons, and I suddenly realized he hadn't yet turned on the sound system. And within 2.5 seconds, I just buckled forward and just felt, I'm dying. This is it. I just felt my organs are collapsing. I actually felt I was being crushed. And he quickly kind of started dialing it down, just said, I didn't want to cause you pain. And I said, how loud was that? And he said, oh, it gets much louder than that. These cars, they're so loud inside them, the air actually begins to act like water. It doesn't feel like air. It's thick. You can't, the molecules are so compressed, and everything sounds underwater. Whenever I listen to my tapes of the music, it sounds like you've stuck a boombox inside of your bathtub, because it's just everything is slowed down. So there's
sound becomes tactile then.
Sound becomes tactile, which is something that we're going to be looking at shortly. And I'll just say that when I then, later on, stood probably close to 20 yards away from the truck of someone known as Tommy the King of Bass, which is the loudest, I think, non-driving truck in the world. I was very far away from this. And when he turned it on, I had a cell phone in my pocket and I was wearing somewhat loose clothing. And suddenly, the cell phone started going like this in my pants, and my clothes were rippling off of top of me. And I could actually see, we were in a strip mall parking lot, and I could see a line of plate glass windows rippling like black sails in a storm. Light bulbs on very high street lamps were starting to vibrate and looked like they were going to fall on all of our heads. And a number of staff from a McDonald's about 100 yards away began running down to us furiously because people could no longer hear their orders as they were being given at the drive-in McDonald's, which I guess is a perennial problem in the parking lot of Tommy the King of Bass when he brings out the Loch Ness Monster, which is what he calls his car. Yes, it's tactile.
You were talking about the relationship between your lust or love for silence and your proximity to reading. And I'd love you to develop a little bit this relationship, because in some way the negative for me is that the desire to be perpetually surrounded by music, as you are describing it now, in stores, in cars, is perhaps a fear of being in solitude or alone. I'm reminded in this particular context of one of the quotations I've most loved by the English psychoanalyst Winnicott, who said that the goal for the child is to be alone in the presence of the mother, which to my mind has always been the best description of reading I have known.
That's beautiful. I can't improve upon that except to say that I'm very aware when I'm hearing sound that, I mean, for me, reading is a process of entering the words physically in some way. And if there's something entering me, if there's sound waves entering me, even if they're not informed by language, I can't go down that particular rabbit hole. It's closed for me. And this may have a great deal to do with attention, which I think is the other aspect of what we are very threatened with in the current noise barrage.
Attention and distraction.
Attention and distraction. I mean, yeah, Schopenhauer called noise the single greatest enemy of the philosopher. And he said that this was so because he said, the only thing that I have, paraphrasing, is my ability to concentrate on one thing for a long period of time. That's
you know,
it.
Simone Weil called that prayer. I mean, she made a direct relationship between attention and being in a state of grace.
I think that's nice. And for Schopenhauer, whose particular bugbear was the cracking of coachmen's whips, he would sit
in his... Imagine him today. Yeah.
I don't think we'd have his books, probably, and it may say something about the books we do have. I mean, and I include my own very much in that. It's, you know, my book is not a steady look at one thing. But what he felt is that interruption that happens was actually, to come back to the question that you raised at the beginning, the interruption of his identity. That there really was nothing left once that concentration was broken of him as philosopher. It was simply gone. And I think we need to read with a devout concentration. I mean, Thoreau has that great line about to read a great book being as difficult as to write it. And Thoreau, to me, is a mentor on silence again and again. I mean, he has extraordinary things to say.
I keep wondering what it means to be attentive in an age of distraction. And, you know, I'm reminded of T.S. Eliot's great line, distracted from distraction by distraction. And I'm prone to it all the time. I mean, my BlackBerry has become, it's my forbidden fruit. My children no longer know it as a fruit, but as a machine. Well, and we, our thoughts, I mean, in your book, you have the story of a painter who feels overtaken, as it were, by sound because he can no longer direct his own life, because the sound is what is directing his life. And the same happens with these machines, which interrupt, and willfully, perhaps, we let them interrupt our life so that we do not have to concentrate, because there might be fear in concentration.
And maybe we should slightly complicate that by saying it's not that we don't concentrate, but we concentrate on the immediate stimulus. We do concentrate. We concentrate on every single thing that is grabbing our attention sonically or visually in our environment.
And there may be great benefits to that.
There are certain benefits. I think there are benefits conceivable, certainly if you're in war. You want that kind of immediately reactive.
Is that the life we're leading?
No, I don't think we're fighting a battle. That's the problem. I think we're fighting ourselves. I mean, we're at war with something deep in our natures. To that point, though, there was a study that I saw very recently that was done by someone who has looked at the limits of the idea, a neuroscientist who has looked at the limits of the idea of multitasking and basically has shown that multitasking is a myth, that we have so much attentive power, and if it goes one place, there's less of it to go somewhere else. And he did a recent study at Vanderbilt looking at what it means to be blinded by surprise. But by blinded, he means overcome, the inability to think. And it appears that there's a part of the brain, a small, modest little part, called the inferior frontal junction, which I thought when I read an account of the study of it almost like a stereoscope, where it brings things into, correlates things into three dimensions. And what this part of the brain does is it correlates external stimuli with directed thought coming from inside us. And in the analogy he used, if the scientist who did the study, if one is reading and a siren goes off outside, an alarm, what happens is we can no longer bring into focus those two tracks of mental activity, and we are literally incapable of further thought for a brief period of time. And certainly to go back to that goal-directed thought is gone. So there is really increasing hard understanding, hard brain understanding, if you will, of the consequences of being interrupted constantly.
In closing, and before I ask you to read a passage, two questions. One is who I take to be the real hero of your book, a man whose work I had never known before, and I'd like you to say something about him because he seems fascinating, both in his work and the way he quite tragically ended, which is Thomas Lessing.
Theodore Lessing. Yes. He was an enormously complicated person, and is now largely forgotten, but he was the one who really wrote first extensively on the idea of the self-hating Jew is maybe the thing. If he's known for anything, he's most known for having defined that concept. He was a Jew himself living in early 20th century Germany, in Hanover primarily. And at one point he became very involved fighting or working with the problem of noise. And he had an enormous number of insights, I felt, into why people make noise. And he was enormously also concerned with various reform movements. He was not in any way an elitist. He worked very, very hard on behalf of the people, and he was very sympathetic to people who made noise. And he talked about the idea that whether it's the coachman cracking his whip or the maid putting out the bedding for a house, or it's a drummer banging on a drum, he said people make noise as a way of magnifying their sphere of power. It's a way of extending your personal space, particularly important for people who don't have that much space, and perhaps we could say in an increasingly overcrowded earth, particularly important for many of us. But what Lessing came to, what he came to as a way of dealing with this, since he wasn't someone who just wanted to try to tell people to shut up who were making a lot of noise, is he began trying to infuse a greater consciousness of the benefits of silence and tried to appeal to people's nobler nature, and said he had this phrase for his organization, quiet is distinguished. And he didn't mean that as a call for the elites to close ranks, but he meant to say to people who didn't have much chance for distinction in their lives, you know, this is a distinction that is available to you. You know, let me show you some of the ways you can get access to it. And he had all sorts of quirky schemes. He wanted to put schools in the middle of woods, and he created houses that would have special colored cards in the windows indicating that no parrots or pianos were allowed, that it was going to be a completely quiet house. And he did all sorts of things. But what I really took from him, and what I really came to feel in the course of my pursuit, is that, all right, the same way I don't think we can say that it is noisier today than it was at X point in the past, but I do think that we can say that there's less silence today than there was in the past. And I think that rather than just being against noise and telling people who often have no experience of silence, be quiet, people who at this point, as I found, literally don't know what that means a lot of times, we've got to start showing them how to be for silence. And we've got to give them a space to do it, and it's got to be experiential. I mean, a line from Thoreau. He said that silence has different depths and fertilities like soil. And I think different silences have different textures and different characters. And we need to give people a chance to explore these if we want our sound world to change.
In closing, really, yeah. You said, in the course of my pursuit, I was very taken by the title of your book, In Pursuit of Silence.
Let me just say to that, the philosopher Kenneth Burke once remarked that mystical silence began in the hunt. And he said that the quest naturally occurs in silence, whether it's an animal stalking its prey or it's a thinker seeking the answer to the question. The start of the question is silence. And this I liked a lot one thought. A lot of what I looked at in the book was the evolutionary history of silence. I mean, why were animals silent to begin with? Well, we lived in a world where noises meant danger and where our ability to hear noises, our ability to take the acoustical temperature of where we were, was a matter of life and death. And I think what we really have to do is find a way of reinvesting interest in the sound of our public spaces so that people, again, want to hear what they sound like rather than wanting to drown them out.
Let me drop my idea of pursuing In Pursuit of Silence and framing you between Descartes and Proust and say that you really are interested in the animal kingdom, because you say here, I thought about frog eggs, snakes. Why did you think about frog eggs? What's so interesting about them?
Well, there was a particular reason I was thinking about frog eggs. It may be a little difficult to speak of briefly, but there's a particular kind of frog egg.
It will connect us to the second
that
part.
That is sensitive to, it will, it's true, if I can articulate it. These frog eggs are sensitive to vibrations in the water where they are laid. And in fact, what these frog eggs have the ability to do is to determine whether the sounds in the water are taking place randomly, like rainfall on the water, in which case they're safe, or they can tell if the vibrations are being made by a snake coming to devour them. And when these larvae sense patterned vibrations, they can prematurely birth themselves and shoot out and become little froglings and get away. So there's a lot to think about there, I think.
I'd like you, in closing, to read a passage. Maybe the oral...
Okay, that's exactly halfway through the book, so
maybe,
that's good.
Or maybe the last pages, or would you like me to read the last page? Because I'd like to leave people with the sound of that last page of yours. I'd love you to read both, but I know we don't have that much time.
I know we don't have time. Well, I don't know how to answer that. I will be silent to your words.
Read the oral truffle.
All right. Well, in the middle of the book, I was very tired with my various explorations of noise, so I wanted some silence. Having neither time nor money for a holiday flight, I decided to go on a tour of oases of silence near my Midtown office. As a matter of principle, pursuing silence should be pleasurable, like hunting for prize wild mushrooms or bathing in mild seas, not painful, like striving to flatten one's stomach or to maintain a stern budget. Wherever you live, there are ways of finding silence. It's just that these ways are often not as pleasant as they should be. Silence is still around, but often it's been marginalized to the point where it conveys the prospect of eternal silence a little too vividly. Abandoned, broken glass-strewn lots behind barbed wire, vacant buildings and mortuaries might be quiet, but at what cost? That said, the basic strategy for locating the remaining sites of silence in your hometown is to envision it as the Costa del Sol. The beach is out of the question. All the places people are naturally drawn to for work, recreation, and shopping are going to be impossibly loud. But a short distance inland cuts the crowds down to a dribble of locals, and suddenly one finds oneself in an authentically foreign place. So ask yourself, what is the interior of the place I live? Where do surf and sand stop? What's the road no one bothers to drive? The bench where no one sits? In many cities, the land underneath the yawning arches where old bridges sink their foundations is a place of refuge, as are the tops of undistinguished skyscrapers. In smaller towns, historical societies and libraries with inadequate internet connections are almost invariably deserted. Museums of unfashionable subjects are a good bet anywhere. You can almost always hear a pin drop in collections attached to schools of medicine. Cemeteries on weekdays, wherever you live, are an obvious but reliable refuge. Just remember to keep asking, where's the culture pulling everyone? Now turn around and walk the other way. Keep walking. Manhattan might not seem like the most promising foraging ground for a couple of hours of silence, but I'm in an especially fortunate area for hunters of that aural truffle. My own circuit is small and more effortless than it might be in many ostensibly quieter communities. And that leads into the pocket parks.
Thank you very much. And now we will move effortlessly into our second part of the evening, and I'd like to encourage all of you to read In Pursuit of Silence. It's a magnificent book. Thank you, George.
Thanks, Paul.